How to survive the sack of Rome. Let's say you want to visit the epicenter of a world power that somehow ruled a quarter of humanity across three continents for more than 500 years at a time when information could travel no faster than horseback. You want to see the famous sports arenas, the chariot races in the 150,000-seat Circus Maximus, the gladiators clash in the great Colosseum. You want to see the stolen art and treasures snatched by the tentacles of a Roman Empire. And at the end of the long day, you want to relax in some of their legendary public baths. So you visit the city of Rome on August 24th, 410 CE. You'll walk the streets of Rome and see the wondrous architectural marvels. You'll see the Pantheon, the Arch of Constantine, the Aurelian Walls, and the Baths of Caracalla. You could catch a show at the Colosseum, more likely a hunt of an exotic animal rather than the rare yet more famous gladiator battles. You might buy sausage or fried fish from the street markets. You'll drink wine in the taverns and maybe gamble a few denarii in a game of Roman dice. Then you might end your evening with a relaxing soak in the Grand Terme Alexandrine, the legendarily luxurious public bathhouse built by Nero and renovated by Emperor Severus Alexander. Bathhouses were the Roman version of pork barrel politics. Emperors commissioned them to appease the masses of their rule, which perhaps explains why they hated Nero built such a nice one. It was equipped with steam rooms, changing rooms, and heated rooms with open roofs. Its pools were fed by the bath's own dedicated aqueduct. Its water warmed by a furnace burning wood chopped from its own dedicated forest, and all of it paid for by the bath's own dedicated tax. If you can find space in this popular bath, you can dunk in its cold pools, swim in its warm ones, or stew in its hot ones. And then sometime late that evening, perhaps just as you're nodding off in one of its soothing spas, you'll be startled by the long blast of a Gothic horn. Rome may have at one time been an empire wealthy and powerful enough to construct this magnificent bathhouse, and the city may have at one time felt so confident in its power it didn't bother building walls. But that time has passed. In 271 CE, Rome began enclosing itself behind the 26-foot Aurelian Walls, and on the night of August 24, 410 CE, 40,000 Visigoth soldiers rushed beyond them. All empires fall, and you have arrived on the precipice of this one's oblivion. Over the next 3 days, Alaric and his Visigothic army will loot and pillage this once mighty global capital. They will burn the Basilica Aemilia, steal the Solomon treasures from Jerusalem, torture Rome's senators, and kill its citizens. As St. Jerome wrote in 416 of the sack, "The renowned city, the capital of the Roman Empire, is swallowed up in one tremendous fire, and there is no part of the earth where Romans are not in exile. Churches once held sacred are now but heaps of dust and ashes. It was as if the bright light of the world were put out." The Visigoths seek golden treasure, and the Terme Alexandrine sit next door to the Temple of Saturn, which serves as Rome's treasury. So you need to leave, quickly. The barbarians are coming, and you only have a few minutes. Grab a towel. How exactly Rome fell from being an empire that once ruled a quarter of the world's population to one the Visigoths could siege and sack has been a topic of academic fascination for at least 1,000 years and has been attributed to nearly as many causes. Historians have alternately explained the fall as a result of everything from crushing taxes to an increasingly organized Gothic foe to a devastating series of plagues, even to mass lead poisoning. But as the Roman historian Edward Gibbon wrote in his seminal 6-volume work, The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Rome's fall should not be seen as surprising or even particularly remarkable because all empires fall. Empires are complex, energetic political systems that always inevitably falter. It's the social version of the second law of thermodynamics. The truly remarkable feature of Rome is not that it fell, but that an empire stretching from the British Isles to the Middle East to Northern Africa lasted as long as it did. Autopsying the fall of Rome is like autopsying the world's oldest person. The causes of death were as varied as they were inevitable. Nevertheless, none of those causes led so directly to a barbarian sword at your throat than Rome's problematic policy of succession. a policy plagued by one severe flaw, its complete lack of existence. Once Julius Caesar demolished the few remaining barriers between republic and monarchy in 44 BCE, the death of a Roman emperor set off a delicate and dangerous transition. Augustus, Caesar's successor and the primary architect of the post-Caesar era of Rome, never established clear rules of succession. Instead, he created a successful but somewhat awkward political system called the Principate, wherein he ruled with an emperor's power while Rome retained much of the former republic's verbiage and institutions. Under Augustus, for example, the Senate remained, but it functioned as an arm of his governance rather than a check on it. Augustus's Principate led to the nearly 200-year run of Roman prosperity called Pax Romana, but it offered no resolution to the problem of succession. Augustus couldn't simply declare his successor, lest he shatter the illusions of Rome as a republic, so instead he left only ambiguity. Rather than the eldest son inheriting the throne as in the later European kingdoms, which, for all its sexist and nepotistic faults, is at least a rule, Roman emperors came to power through some combination of backroom deals, violence, timing, and proximity. Even in relatively stable eras, this process resulted in a dangerous, deadly, ever more frequent series of coups. After the Roman Emperor Nero committed suicide to avoid execution in 68 CE, his next three successors all died of assassination or suicide in a single year, and that was during an otherwise stable Roman era. After the so-called crisis of the 3rd century began in 235, when emperors discarded even the Principate's nods toward republicanism, the path to power ran through revolts, the military, assassination, and civil war. The emperor's job was always dangerous, but in the late Roman era it became almost ludicrously so. More than half of the 59 emperors who ruled from 193 to 476 were either assassinated or executed. Another four committed suicide, five died in battle, and in an era when poisons were practically undetectable, many of the rest died with suspicious fevers. During the 49-year crisis of the 3rd century, spanning from 235 to 284 CE, only two of the era's 28 emperors died naturally. One would think this kind of job risk would discourage applicants, but the exact opposite occurred. Instead, emperors rerouted much of Rome's resources to gain and then stay in power. From 253 to 268, Emperor Gallienus fought six separate rebellions before he was finally assassinated. The unsustainable turmoil at the top buckled the empire. In Rome's late period, it fought more than 50 civil wars, which killed far more Romans than the so-called barbarians. These civil wars created such an unquenchable thirst for troops that emperors began to recruit soldiers from beyond Rome's borders, including a man named Alaric, who was from what is now Romania. Alaric wasn't a Roman citizen, but he was at times a Roman general, which was a common paradox in a Roman military that relied heavily upon foreign troops. He served in a role similar to a modern-day military contractor, alternately fighting either for or against Rome, depending on whether he had recently entered into a treaty or whether he was negotiating, i.e., ransoming, a new one. On September 5, 394, after the Visigoths suffered heavy casualties fighting for the Emperor Theodosius in his civil war against the usurper Eugenius, Alaric tore up his treaty with Rome and pursued a better one using the traditional Gothic negotiating strategy. He invaded. Initially, he found some success, but after a new administration altered the deal, Alaric marched his Visigoths to the gates of Rome itself. He demanded to be named commander of Rome's Western Army, as well as land, food, and recurring payments for his soldiers. When the senators asked what he intended on leaving Rome's citizens if they refused, their souls was his only response. The Emperor Honorius, safely tucked away in the city of Ravenna, declined Alaric's demands. So, on the night of August 24, 410, those 40,000 Visigoths slipped through the Salarian Gate in the Aurelian Walls and put Rome to the sack. Footnote: how exactly they made it past the wall has been a matter of debate since the day it occurred. Some accounts suggest a Trojan horse-like gambit from Alaric, some suggest treachery, and still others blame hunger or desperation from the Romans themselves. When Alaric's bugles blast out their triumph, They call out from the Salarian Gate in the city's far northeastern corner. This is good. You're in the Terme Alexandrine, a mile and a half from the breach, so you have some time before the Goths arrive. Generally, the advice for surviving a sack is as simple as it is imperative. Run! To an ancient sacking army, there was no distinction between citizens and soldiers. All were tortured, killed, or enslaved with equal impunity. This wasn't considered a war crime or even came as a surprise. It was simply expected. Medieval kings paid their armies with plunder, a payment that included the enslavement and freedom to commit acts of wanton brutality against a city that refused to surrender. Any life spared was a charity you would be ill-advised to hope for. Unfortunately, where exactly you should go is far less straightforward. The historical and archaeological record of the sack is scant, with only a few surviving sources and almost none that provide precise details. Even worse, the sources contradict one another. Where you should run, then, depends on who you believe. If you believe the Christian philosophers, Augustine of Hippo and Orosius, you will save yourself by escaping into a church. Alaric, as a Christian, took mercy on the Christian edifices and worshippers in the city, according to Orosius. He writes, "The Christian king Alaric went to great lengths to protect Christian buildings and treasures." The philosopher Augustine concurs and even recommends a specific church, Old St. Peter's Basilica in what is now Vatican City. If he's correct, surviving the siege is fairly simple. The basilica is less than a mile to your west. If you move quickly, you can make it there before the Visigoths. Once inside, you can ride out their three-day pillage under Alaric's merciful protection. But should you bet your life on these accounts? Perhaps not. Almost immediately after the sack, the act itself became something of a political football between Europe's competing Christian and pagan factions. Rome had converted to Christianity in 323 CE, but plenty of its citizens still practiced paganism, and these pagans argued the sack was the gods' punishment for Rome's religious treachery. This created something of a conflict of interest among the Christian chroniclers, who now had incentive to emphasize the Christian Alaric's charity. Augustine himself admits as much in his Retractions. Those who worship the multitude of false gods, whom we usually call pagans, try to lay the blame for this disaster on the Christian religion. This fired me with zeal for the house of God, and I began to write the city of God to confute their blasphemies and falsehood. Perhaps Alaric's soldiers spared those who hid in churches, as Augustine claims, but his bias, along with the few surviving clues from the archaeological record, should give you some pause before you bet your life on it. The Basilica Aemilia, a church in the north of the city that Pliny the Younger once considered the most beautiful building in all of Rome, burned so hot in the sack that coins melted to its floor. Socrates Scholasticus, a Christian church historian in Constantinople, doesn't describe the sack in particularly peaceful terms either. In 440 CE, he wrote that the barbarians at last took Rome itself, which they pillaged, burning the greatest number of the magnificent structures and other admirable works of art it contained. The money and valuable articles they plundered and divided among themselves. Many of the principal senators they put to death on a variety of pretexts. Scholasticus's account falls far more in line with the typical treatment of sacked cities in ancient and medieval times. So, despite Augustine's and Orosius's claims, it seems you risk a significant chance of being treated according to the traditional medieval rules of war if you stay. In other words, you should run. The Goths pour into Rome from the north, so obviously you can't run there. You might think you should run away from them to the south, but that probably isn't a good idea either. If you run south, you'll run toward the Temple of Vespasian, which houses the legendary treasure from Jerusalem's Solomon Temple that the Emperor Titus stole when he sacked the city in 70 CE. Treasure that includes the Ark of the Covenant, if you believe some legends. The Goths loot the Solomon treasure, according to Procopius. You don't want to be in their way when they do. So, instead of running directly away from the invading army, you should head east toward the Colosseum. You may even be able to see the top of the great arena from the street. Run toward it. As you go, take particular care to avoid Rome's wealthier districts like Palatine Hill and Aventine. The Goths torture the wealthy for information about their gold's whereabouts. If you travel through the poorer districts, generally the city's lowlands, you will not only see fewer soldiers, but those that you do see may be less inclined to torture you. Maybe. Once you reach the Colosseum, continue east toward the Matronia Gate on the southeastern edge of the city. Unfortunately, it's unknown whether you'll find the gate open and unguarded. That detail has been lost. You'll just have to hope. But you do have history on your side, which suggests sacking soldiers usually rush in to gather their share of the spoils. If the Visigoth soldiers of fortune flood the city, you may find the gate open and the city unguarded. From there, you can wait out the sack in the safety of the surrounding hills. Fortunately, the sack of Rome is mercifully brief. The Visigoths are after gold. They're not occupiers. Once they grab every piece of wealth they can carry, and even some they can't, including a reported 2,000-pound silver cup, they continue south. After only 3 days, Alaric and his army leave and you can return to the city. You may even be able to continue your Roman vacation, because Alaric's invasion doesn't officially end the Roman Empire. It merely strikes the mortal blow. The Western Roman Empire stumbles on for another 60 years, during which time its population drops by 75%. In another 500 years, all of Rome can comfortably squeeze into the Colosseum's bleachers, and the disused arena will serve as a shanty town. Rather than fielding grand games, it will house cots, tents, and vagrants. By 1000 CE, Rome takes on a certain Planet of the Apes vibe, a once massive and decadent city, now sparsely populated and technologically defunct. But that's not what you'll return to. Many Romans do survive, as do many of its buildings, including the Terme Alexandrine. You can go back. You'll find a little more space this time.